You keep on searching, keep on searching, mighty love, mighty, mighty. Welcome to The Kingless Generation, a podcast on the deep history of class struggle, paleo-parapolitics, and the demonology of capital. I'm your host, Fergal Schmoodlock, and I have for you today a real return to form for this podcast, our classic wheelhouse of paleo parapolitics. As James C. Scott says in Against the Grain, you know, the state originated as a protection racket in which one band of robbers prevailed. That's on page 268, note 23. And just, I want to riff with that. As a communist, and this being a communist podcast, a historical materialist podcast, but now getting into this mythology that may have a whole lot of truth in it, I think it does have a whole lot of truth in it, from a communist perspective. These religions of absolute truth and of good and evil are artifacts, as many historians tell us, of an age that they call the Axial Age. And that is right around the turn of the Common Era, right? The era that's often named after Jesus, right? Well, the time that he lived was a time of great ancient empires spanning the Eurasian continent and beginning to move capital around between them, sucking in huge numbers of slaves and creating a whole new kind of consciousness of human history, that human history, you know, something has happened here, something has really changed, and also something might really be wrong, and when this might be careening toward a terrible end, but there might be a way to stop that end and bring about a great happy ending for the universe. And that's what so many of these religions are about. The great Chinese state ideologies would go in this basket, Confucianism, whatever kinds of, there's different syntheses of different thought of different thinkers at this time. And basically the whole, you know, many philosophers of the spring and autumn period who are all competing, including the Taoists, including the ones who are sort of anti-structure. You read Zhuangzi, you read Laozi, they both are trying to sell their ideology to some kind of king who is trying to find a way to stabilize the state, this new monster, this new Leviathan, which stands astride the Eurasian continent and threatens to devour it whole. Now, this is a story of the Eurasian continent, and it doesn't really apply to anything in the so-called Americas. That's a whole different story. We won't get into that today. And there's more that I could say. There's a bigger picture. I'm going to try to stop myself from getting into this bigger picture too much today and really just focus more on two books, really, Jubilees and First Enoch. These are two books that what really draws them together is that they were crucial to the worldview of the authors of the New Testament and to much of Second Temple Judaism, which is sort of the Judaism of Jesus. First Enoch is quoted directly by the letter of Jude in the New Testament, in every kind of Bible, including Protestant Bibles. But only the Ethiopic Church actually keeps these two books as canonical scripture. And so as a result, the full text of each of these is only available in Ethiopic or Ge'ez. This is an Afro-Asiatic language that is, I think, not quite Semitic, right? But it is spoken in the venerable land of Ethiopia. And these two books are mainly preserved there, but Jubilees was originally composed in Hebrew, then translated to Greek, and then from the Greek was probably translated the Ge'ez version that we have the full text of. There's Hebrew, though, preserved in the Dead Sea Scrolls, right, from the caves at Qumran. Those were made available. They were first discovered, apparently the story goes, and this is an area that I would love to go deeper into. They were first discovered in 1947. 47. That would be the year right before the founding of the Zionist entity, the British colony that is the Brits conspired to depopulate all of the members of the Jewish religion from Europe and make them lead a settler colonial white supremacist state there in Palestine and use that as a geopolitical pawn, which they continue to do to this day, toward ends which you and I continue to wonder about, even as we are horrified out of our minds by the genocidal fury of not only the Israeli offense forces, but also all kinds of ordinary people in the Zionist entity. And, you know, we should be thinking about that and how that works, by the way. But so 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered. So apparently by an Arab shepherd just finds them, supposedly. And then, but it's not until 1991 that all of the Dead Sea Scrolls material is opened to full public consumption. And that, isn't that another very interesting date? Anything, can you think of anything else that happened in 1991 that is of world historical interest? And you might think about what, you know, how did the Zionist entity move during all that time? And what was, so, yeah, we can, I'd love to both run wild but with that, but also very carefully study what is going on there. So you have then a parallel situation with First Enoch. It's called First Enoch because there is a Second Enoch, which is only extant in very late Church Slavonic. And there are some other things. There are fragments of other things as well now, earlier, that do exist. So there's some questioning of that, but in general, it's not approached by secondary literature. Like, for example, for this episode, I mainly read Lauren Stuckenbrock's book, The Myth of Rebellious Angels. And that has a whole bunch of essays that he has written, not together as a monograph, but separately, but all on this same theme. And I'm sharing with you things from that, and I've read in detail First Enoch. So First Enoch was originally written in Aramaic, not Hebrew, and it too was translated to Greek and then to Ethiopic, Ge'ez, and the Ge'ez is what we have the full text of. But then there too, the Qumran community had a lot of copies of different parts of it. Different parts of it because First Enoch is, you know, conservatively, what did the Vanderkam version have, like 5 parts or 10 parts? Stuckenbrock lists 20 parts that he divides First Enoch into and that he thinks are originally independent texts. And most people think that these are independent texts. They repeat material, they have totally different compositional frames and so on. And they're all stitched together kind of like it's like a drawer. It's like a bag, grab bag of things that have something to do with this figure of Enoch, right? We want to keep our eye, too, of course, on the importance of Enoch for early modern bourgeois mythology. The bourgeoisie is born out of a Southern European barbarian elite who have absorbed very advanced Islamic science and technology and are appropriating their capital networks as they begin to take over the Mediterranean at first. And of course, the Crusader Project allows various Italian city-states entrees into the Silk Road and all of the tremendous amount of value that is moving around there. And so they begin to take part in merchant capital networks there. and they're gathering new knowledge about the world, and they're rediscovering their entire kind of Abrahamic heritage and also like the Hellenistic synthesis heritage, much of which had been lost during the so-called Middle Ages, when on the one hand, you had what James C. Scott would call a kind of the kind of collapse about which he says, you know, long live collapses, because the lives of people were much less closely controlled by ruling classes. Class struggle receded into the background. And you could really think of a lot of the European hinterland as, quote unquote, you know, returning to an indigenous way of life or something, right? Or a way of life that is not characterized by the kind of high-pitched class struggle that produces the Axial Age across the Eurasian continent. Okay, so I'm telling you that First Enoch is this grab bag of texts. It is translated into Greek. We have a Syriac version and a Latin version from much later. And then there, too, in Qumran, we have a lot of Aramaic versions, fragments of the Aramaic. We have a lot of fragments of the Greek, too. And so all of that has been combined together. So for both Jubilees and First Enoch, Jubilees, by the way, the content of it is a dialogue between God and Moses on Mount Sinai. On the occasion of the giving of the law, God gives Moses this kind of authoritative version of this is like salvation history, basically. And it is the view of salvation history that is taken for granted in the New Testament of Christianity, but is never explained anywhere in the Masoretic Hebrew Bible that is, again, kept by medieval Judaism. It's also not explained in the Catholic Bible, right? It's only the Ethiopic Bible that keeps these two books, interestingly, right? Even the Catholic and the Greek Orthodox canons are content to leave that knowledge in the realm of church tradition and not give it to you from those books directly. And I'll go ahead and say why I think that is. I think that's because it's a slightly different vision. You have things like the Trinity in formation. You have things like the doctrine of evil. The idea of evil is still in formation. It's only half-baked. And it would contradict, it would conflict with the full Christian view of good and evil and of the Trinity and these things that you see in a different way in the book of Revelations. That's the best thing to compare it to. And the Lauren Stuckenbrook book ends with a wonderful essay going through Revelations with a fine-tooth comb and comparing all of its paratexts in mainly First Enoch. There's a preponderance of passages and details and phrases, ways things are phrased and associated with, you know, thing A is phrased in this way and it's associated with thing B in ways that suggest pretty strong influence, either direct or very proximately from First Enoch. But even so, it would conflict. It would conflict. So you couldn't, you know, having actually First Enoch in your Bible would be a little bit confusing because you have, well, you have figures like the ancient, the one, the first time he appears, one of the figures around the heavenly court, as we get the tour, the grand tour, we get one with a head of days, which I think means one who has a head that looks very old, a venerable head, you know, and an old head. No, it probably doesn't mean the same thing as an old head in modern colloquial English. But the first time you see him, he's called one with a head of days. Later, he's just called the head of days. And maybe once or twice in First Enoch, he's the ancient of days. But the ancient of days is something that you get further developed in more canonical things, right? Even a paratext like Daniel, right? Daniel, the Old Testament prophet, shares a lot of scenes with both Jubilees and First Enoch. Things like a heavenly court judging various, you know, it changes who's being judged exactly, but you get a similar scene in such a way. Stuckenbrock actually shows that Daniel probably depends on First Enoch, and maybe also a independent text in Qumran, you know, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that is known sometimes as the Genesis Apocryphon. So again, the Old Testament might not be as old. It's not the oldest thing. It isn't as if the Old Testament is totally, the text is totally fixed and it's done and it's set in stone. Literally, you know, archaeologically, that's how we can know that something really comes from a given time period. Maybe if it's preserved in a really a way that we know when it was inscribed, and we have an actual inscribed object that we know is old, right? Then you can really, oh, this was really written at this time, right? And you can get all kinds of revelations about, oh, this is what the Zhou dynasty was actually thought about the Shang dynasty, as opposed to what, you know, Han dynasty recensions of that, right? Or Song dynasty recensions of that, you know, thousands of years later, thought about that relationship. Well, if you look at a bronze, right, an actual bronze inscription from China, then you can really go back to that time period, right? But so the Old Testament, though, the so-called Old Testament, might not be that old. Sometimes there are things in it which can date to much later. And one example of that, I guess, let's jump right in here, would be at the beginning of 1 Enoch, chapter 6. And just like Genesis, actually, it's Genesis chapter 6, where we get this brief little story about the sons of God, it is there, who came down to earth and married with the daughters of men. And in Genesis, it says there were daughters born to men, and the sons of God desired them and went into them, and from them were born the mighty men, the great ones of old, and the Nephilim, that gets translated into Greek as hoi gigantes, which is the giants. And so subsequent tradition defines these as giants. But as with everything else, you should always let the Hebrew be its own thing. And the Greek translation is going to be a Hellenistic synthesis, vintage interpretation of the Hebrew, which is much earlier, and maybe it's much earlier. Definitely a certain stratum is much earlier and reflects concerns that are totally different. We don't know. Like I mentioned just before, you know, like Jonathan Adler's book takes up things like the Elephantine papyri. There were Jews. We can tell that there were Jews living in a region of Egypt called Elephantine. And that was a fort that stood just before the first cataract of the Nile. And during the second intermediate period, 1650 to 1550 BCE, the fort marked the southern border of Egypt. And we have historical texts from the Middle Kingdom related to that. And in that, we can find Jews. We can find Jews, and they have names that are named, they're named after other gods that we know about, like Egyptian gods and things. That is an example. I'd love to go deeper into that, but that would be a place where they're not practicing Judaism as we know it. We don't seem to have what Jonathan Adler calls Judeans yet. It doesn't seem to exist. And something else probably exists. You know, what that is something that I'd be really interested in kind of scraping the surface of. I doubt we could do much more than scrape the surface of it, given the state of evidence. But there are sources like that where you could really get into it. But again, as Adler says, there's no evidence for anything earlier than the Hasmonean period, after the Maccabean revolt against the Persians, right? And so it seems to be the whole creation of the religion of Judaism. One theory that you could go with would be that it's a result of that act of national liberation, really. So that, you know, that raises an interesting... I sometimes wonder if what they're doing with the Zionist entity right now is shit-coding national liberation, the whole idea of national liberation, because it is the worst example. It is the example of the worst thing, worst direction for any kind of liberation project to go. Of course, it is not really a liberatory project at all. There's a video clip of Kwame Ture going around right now, which I put on the Discord, where he says, you know, if it was a liberatory project, it would be they would be fighting some hegemon. Instead, the Zionist entity gets the help of the hegemon, of the British Empire, to drive these other people off the land, who are definitely not hegemons. But anyway, that's just one little hypothesis that's been rolling around in my head, and I think I'll throw out there that they could let the Zionist entity go, let it get destroyed, get wrecked, and then turn around and say, look, that's what happens whenever you have national liberation. You want national liberation? You want to become another Zionist entity? Look what happened with that. And that'll be the new taboo? I don't know. Who knows? At this point, it's very much in flux. I will say that I think there's definitely evidence that they're scrambling. They don't know what's going on. There's also evidence that they at least partially let Al-Aqsa flood happen or start or get, you know, some part of the way. And I think maybe it got a little out of control. And the forces of resistance are just displaying the absolute heavenly heights of revolutionary struggle, which you can only just stand in awe of. And really, up to this point, isn't that the way it has to go? With all of this surveillance apparatus, which is also very Enochian, this very Enochian dream of writing down and recording every single thing that happens in the universe, we will see that impulse has maybe origins here. I don't know if it has origins here, but it has its expression here as well. We've already covered the way that writing as a technology arises with the grain state, with the need to gather a certain amount of taxes from everyone, who paid, how much, and also sending value, trading. You need to have writing. And then, of course, you need to have a scribal class. And it's the scribal class who then records and writes down everything about everyone else. And then you have in many times and places, as I've discussed in maybe the episode called Combat Parasocialism is one. I took up the Book of Tot, the Egyptian Book of Tot, not the various Greek language hermetic traditions that are much more just kind of products of a class of sort of declassed Egyptian priesthood. Anyone with any kind of connection to the Egyptian priesthood was just wandering around teaching in Greek about the secrets of the Egyptians, the secrets of Hermes Trismegistus, or Tot. But that would be something akin to the many sort of settler spirituality, those who peddle New Age settler spirituality to people in places like the United States, right? And maybe some of these people even have some connection to indigenous groups, right? It'd be a very similar thing in Ptolemaic Egypt in the wake of the Empire of Alexander the Great, which, by the way, it's kind of wrong that I'm first just mentioning Alexander the Great at this point, of course. Alexander the Great, when he dies in 323, all the different kind of administrations that he leaves behind become all these units under which things like the Maccabean Revolt happen, right? And the Hasmonean Dynasty and the creation of Second Temple Judaism, all of this, right? You know, the Roman Empire comes in and takes over and creates the province of Judea, the Roman province of Judea. But of course, before that, the really big event is the invasion of Alexander the Great. And again, your early modern elites, your proto-bourgeoisie, they know all about this too. I read recently The Game of Saturn, Decoding the Sola Busca Tarocchi. That's by Peter Mark Adams, I think it is. You know, that's a Satanist book by people who maybe kind of want, he doesn't say this, but, you know, the whole vibe of the publishing house that it's on, Scarlet Imprint, is definitely that we're interested in this stuff because we also want to perpetuate this kind of spirituality, which is the spirituality that gave birth to the rapacious modern bourgeoisie. So there's can be nothing liberatory or progressive about it in one sense, but it is full of really interesting historical knowledge, which is not normally, most people don't know about. The rediscovery of Neoplatonism and all of this. So that deck of cards, anyway, leans very far into the idea that Alexander has this deep world historical meaning. There are many cards that refer to Alexander and the legend of his mother being impregnated by Saturn in the form of a dragon and giving birth to him. And this would connect right up with this mythology of disobedient angels that we're talking about today. Those resonances, maybe I will just say right now as well that Stuckenbrock concludes in the first paper included in the book that I'm referring to, that the idea of the rebellious angels owes something to the dual pantheon or the substitution of pantheons, right? Of the Titans are substituted by the gods in the Greek world. And that presence of that double pantheon in the Hellenistic world inspired the creation of these fallen angels, perhaps, is what Stuckenbrock says. I would go back even further, and I'm not going to go into this deeply this time. I have other material that I'll get into for this, but I would point toward the Indian-Iranian split. And what's that? One of the great early so-called civilizations, early huge grain states, maybe, anyway, something big was happening. We don't always know, right? Sometimes things are like these Ukrainian mega cities that have no elite dwellings or slave dwellings or anything. It's just palaces for the people. Early experimentation with large-scale human civilization shows that some, whatever kind of like class struggle virus or, you know, whatever kind of pattern or momentum, whatever you want to say, hadn't started in whatever place, right? Or maybe they found their way out of it. Maybe it had existed before and they found their way out of it, right? Poverty Point at the mouth of the Mississippi River would be another example of one of these really big civilizations, clearly, where people are moving a lot of value around, people are producing a lot of value, creating a very rich lifestyle for a huge amount of people, but there's no sign of inequality or war. And you can see those things in the archaeological record, right? So there could be lots of that. I'm talking about the Indus Valley civilization. The Indus Valley civilization. Sadly, this is one of the most poorly studied civilizations. You know, that's the theme already in this episode. Think about what it is that puts the powers that be into a given archaeological site and gets them investigating a certain archaeological find, right? I'll just raise again those dates of the Dead Sea Scrolls, 1947, and then they're finally fully released in 1991, and it's years after that that the full text is kind of released in your nice, clean Penguin Classics edition. I think it's in the early 2000s is the one that I have. So the Indus Valley civilization is extremely vast. It actually covers the greatest land area of any of the early civilizations. Something I was reading in Japanese, I think. I was reading the one thing. And on either side of that, you have the birth of two kind of parallel civilizations, both Indo-European languages of Sanskrit. You have the, you know, they're known as the Aryan, the Indo-Aryans, right? And then you have the Iranian civilization to the west. And the Indus Valley stands between those two. And you could think of it as a kind of split. And the really interesting thing that you notice when you're reading the sacred texts of these two civilizations, the ones that really line up are the Vedas, particularly the Rig Veda in the Indian tradition, and then the Avesta in the Iranian tradition, or the Persian tradition, right? There's this whole thing. Persia seems to be actually a bit of a later name, perhaps. And, you know, that it's because of a certain, you know, centered on the region and the city of Persepolis are some of the later dynasties. But anyway, that whole name change is the subject of another Zionist red herring about Iran that, similar to the canard about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem being the one who planned the Holocaust and made Hitler do it by planning the whole idea in his head when he never thought to do that before. Very similar to that, they have this idea that the Nazis were, and they, you know, they were trying to cultivate friends in the area of the Middle East where the Brits had their colonial holdings, and they were trying to get in. And that was part of why the Brits and the Americans finally decided to pull the plug on their whole little Nazi experiment and their Nazi bulldog that they had rampaging there, because they started to put their hands on British colonial holdings there. So that was a bridge too far. And they were failing to defeat the Soviet Union anyway. So much like the ISIS, you know, ISIS being left to be overthrown by the heroic resistance of the Syrian people, etc. And then all the leaders of ISIS were helicoptered out again, just the way they came in, back to American military bases to be debriefed and healed up and all of that. Very similarly, the Nazis' project was controlled demolition, and they were all spirited away to South America and all of that. So that being the truth, there is a Zionist idea that the name change of Persia to Iran was inspired by the Nazis. When the Nazis were coming in there, they told them, you're Aryan, we love the Aryans, the Aryan race, and you should get back in touch with that heritage, buddy. And that's what they told them, and that's the only reason that they decided to call themselves Iran. Well, I don't think that's true. But you have this split. So you have this split, and then you have, there you have a double pantheon. There you have, in both places, you have devas, the deva, which is cognate with deus, you know, God in Latin, right? Devas in Sanskrit are a newer group of entities, and then you have this older group of entities called the asuras. The asura, this word asura comes from a word meaning lord. So you have the gods and the lords. And this Lord God thing, you know, you can almost picture it like a kind of Deleuze and Guattari striation of space proceeding across the Eurasian continent or something. I don't know. But the really cool thing that you have is that the devas and sometimes the asuras are discussed in the Vedas as just being both two different kinds of gods. Somehow the asuras are older, you know, the devas are newer somehow. Whatever, they both can be prayed to, they both guard the land and make the land bounteous and prosperous. When you pour purely refined ghee made from the finest butter on the rippling muscles on the back of this or that god. His muscles just shine and ripple, and it's beautiful. Just sparkling, oily muscles. There's all kinds of things like that in the Rig Veda. Meanwhile, in the Avesta, already before, it seems, Zarathustra, who is this prophet that we have to really reconstruct a lot of things, because with the Islamic conquest of Persia, you have the Avestan material is passed on. The Zoroastrians flee to India. Apparently, they also flee to China. I just heard the other day from a friend of mine who specializes in that. But in largely, it's in India, and we have reports of the Avesta in late antiquity being this enormous book. Maybe it's the 9th century. We know that it was like 20 books long or something. Now we have a much shorter thing, very fragmentary thing, because of this transmission. And the earliest manuscripts are definitely from the 2nd millennium CE. But in that, there the Ahuras. There is one Ahura, Ahura Mazda, but you know he's surrounded by kind of less semi-divine good beings as well. He's connected to goodness, and the bad characters are the Daewas, and that's cognate with Deva. So the Devas become bad guys in that. The gods are God. If God equals Deva, the gods are demonized, and then one single lord, one single Ahura, like, you know, cognate to the Asura in Sanskrit, becomes this good cosmic principle. So I will have more to say about that. I've probably already got too deep into that for our purposes this time, but I want to point to that. I want to point to that, actually. In contrast to Stuckenbrock, maybe I wouldn't go with gods versus titans. Ultimately, I would go back to Daewa versus Ahura. And that Persian model, I think, has lots and lots of influence on the Greek worldview. And it also would connect to the kind of Platonic Orientalism that you see in Neoplatonism, you know, late Platonism, you can call it, Neoplatonic mysticism that is being rediscovered by people like the Ferraran dukes of that are creating the Sola Busca Tarocchi, right, in the Renaissance period. So in the Italian Renaissance, you're getting this rediscovery of Platonic Orientalism that looks to Persia and says, wow, those guys in Persia, they worship. Can you believe it? They think that the gods, the devas, are evil, and actually they worship this other thing, Ahura Mazda. Could it be that you know, some telephone game arises, and you get a kind of antinomianism among some people as a result of that? Yeah, we're going to do the... I mean, of course, Zoroastrians are not thinking in this way. Zoroastrian texts associate nothing but, you know, goodness. There's a real specific kind of set of a kind of good life that it seems that Zoroaster, and then maybe I shouldn't get too deep into that. Suffice it to say that even the Old Testament, right? Even the Old Testament has sources. It has things that it's influenced by, and if there was some kind of, well, there was surely some original moment of compilation of the Pentateuch, right, the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, as some kind of core, probably. There's the theory that would have been the product of Persian scholarship or Persian sponsorship of, like, hey, we're doing, a woke government grant to, we're going to do minority studies. It's just like in America, as a counterinsurgency measure, they started African-American studies and they started cultural studies programs in all the universities. And you can read speeches by Fred Hampton and Huey P. Newton decrying this as a way to sap revolutionary energy, to give cultural recognition. And there's a monograph called From Black Power to Black Studies, How a Radical Social Movement Became an Academic Discipline by Fabio Rojas, which is about that counterinsurgency moment with respect to the Black American liberation movement, the New African liberation movement of the 60s and 70s, right? But yeah, there's this theory then that maybe something like that happened in the right ancient Persian Empire, and that's where the core of the Torah came from. Who knows? But supposing, even if you don't suppose such direct Persian influence, you have to imagine with the Babylonian captivity and all of this, there definitely has to be influence there. And the Avestan worldview of good and evil is the first apocalyptic vision on record as well in world history. Zarathustra has some kind of apocalyptic vision where there will be an end of the world, where Ahura Mazda will finally defeat the forces of the lie, right? The truth. People who are in the truth are truth havers as opposed to lie havers. And the lie havers will finally be defeated at some moment in the future. And what gets us there is a succession of prophets, kind of whom Zarathustra is one, or maybe, yeah, there will be prophets of different ages who are miraculously born from Zarathustra's seed somehow. And meanwhile, going east, you have a non-dual tradition in Sanskrit in India, which doesn't adopt this dualistic worldview, keeps an eternal view of the world, does not adopt this kind of salvation history kind of framework. But there's a way in which you can think about everything from Iran to the West as being strongly influenced by this kind of view. Shit, I'm going on too long about this, but it'll still be interesting when I discuss it in its own right later. One more thing. Over in Japan, in Japanese Buddhism, I think I've already mentioned that the five paths of existence that are seen among them, one of them is the realm of asuras. And that's that figure of the Lord. In Japanese Buddhism, that is a kind of hell for nobles. Hell for noblemen is to be reborn as an asura, and the asuras are in some asura realm where they just eternally fight each other constantly. It's a kind of like Black Mirror episode where you have to just fight and fight and fight, and as soon as one fight is done, it just starts all over again. And that's one of two kind of hells. They're neatly paired between the two main classes of the feudal state. The other hell is, you'll remember, the realm of hungry ghosts, where you experience again and again the worst fate that a peasant can imagine, which is to starve to death. So, totally different story. No connection. It's fun to experience that as well. You know, on the one hand, in this story, in this podcast, we will uncover patterns and it'll be really cool. Hey, this is connected to this other thing. Other times we will realize, hey, there's no connection. This is arbitrary. There's no motivation. There's no destiny here. And that's liberating too. That's very liberating. We need both of those. Oh, we see the connections. We see how things work. We see the laws of motion of the class forces in history, all of that. But then we also see these revolutionary ruptures where, oh, something totally different can come out of this. You just go this direction. Oh, it's just totally different. You don't have to obey any of the old laws of this other thing. You don't even have to rebel against them. You can just forget about them, etc. So I was saying, in Genesis 6, it's actually an impoverished and weirdly abbreviated version of the story of the rebellious watchers, right? Or angels. It is, in Genesis, it's the sons of God that come down on earth and pair with human women, the daughters of men. Daughters were born to them, and so it says in Genesis chapter 6. That doesn't make a lot of sense, actually. Daughters were born, and so the causality there, I think that I'm getting that from the commentary of Black, which is on Brill. It's the commentary on First Enoch from the 1990s. And Black points this out and says this. That's not in Stuckenbrock. But I like it because, you know, that causality doesn't make any sense. In First Enoch, here you go. Chapter 6, verse 1. When the sons of men had multiplied in those days, beautiful and comely daughters were born to them. Beautiful and comely daughters. Now we get a motivation. Okay, the daughters are very beautiful. Now we get a motivation. And the watchers, the sons of heaven, not the sons of God, the sons of heaven, the watchers. This is a verb that means to stay awake. The ones who stay awake, right? The guards of the universe, basically. The watchers, the sons of heaven, saw them and desired them. And they said to one another, come, let us choose for ourselves wives from the daughters of men, and let us beget children for ourselves. And Shemihazah, their chief, said to them, I fear that you will not want to do this deed, and I alone shall be guilty of a great sin. And they all answered him and said, let us all swear an oath, and let us all bind one another with a curse, that none of us turn back from this counsel until we fulfill it and do this deed. Then they all swore together and bound one another with a curse. And they were all of them 200 who descended in the days of Jared unto the peak of Mount Hermon. So there's a particular mountain. And they called the mountain Hermon because they swore and bound one another with a curse on it. And these are the names of their chiefs. Shemihazah, this one was their leader. Artikof, second to him. Remash-el, third to him. Kokabel, fourth to him. And we got a bunch of names, right? Asael, who is in this list, later on, in when we get into probably a tradition that comes from a different composition, Asael becomes the leader of the fallen watchers, the disobedient watchers. But then you get this list, right, of them. And the deed and its results. This is so I'm reading here from the translation of Vanderkam and Nicholsberg. That's in the Hermeneia series. The Hermeneia series of commentaries on these texts is the best and most recent of these. And they alone are based on the fully available Dead Sea Scrolls material, which again, 1991. What are they trying to do to me here? I'm going to lose it. So still in First Enoch, this is chapter 7 now. These and all the others with them took for themselves wives from among them, such as they chose. And they began to go into them and to defile themselves through them and to teach them sorcery and charms and to reveal to them the cutting of roots and plants. So those are obviously very fascinating for us. They defile themselves with them. And that's a very interesting thing. The idea that the women are defiled is not present here. You'll see that in some other texts, but not here. Here, this sexual activity that is forbidden, a man chooses to do it, and the man defiles himself by doing it. We see they teach them sorcery and charms. This will be important as we go on as well. And reveal to them the cutting of roots and plants. This is medicine. This is medicine. And you see already within the oldest layer of the Hebrew Bible an ambivalence about medicine. There are some texts that would completely forbid any kind of medicine. You know, God, literally, God is your doctor, and you shouldn't have any other doctor. There are passages like that. But then there are other ones where an angel teaches someone, particularly, you know, even in the oldest layer, there are moments where it is medicine is approved of. And that's why you have, even to this day, among kind of new cults and new sects and new kinds of religions in America, for example, you have people who rediscover the prohibitions on medicine, and they say, oh yeah, you shouldn't actually have any medicine. And then in the Deuterocanonicals, though, you really see a lot of embrace of medicine, like the Book of Tobit. In the Book of Tobit, there's a very explicit kind of a disease, an ailment, blindness is caused by a particular chemical substance falling in the eye. And as a result of that, an angel teaches a main character to produce a medical ointment preparation out of a particular biological substance, out of parts of a fish, and then use that, put that on the eye, and that sort of physically, chemically solves the problem, relieves the ailment, right? But it's definitely licit, especially because an angel of God came and told you about it, a non-rebellious one. But that line between rebellious and non-rebellious is very fine, actually, you'll find. I'll go ahead and say, Stuckenbrock has a whole chapter about 1 Corinthians, Paul talking about women. Maybe he's talking about they should have a power on their head. He writes in Greek that is pretty obscure and is kind of colloquial to, and maybe specific to this bilingual, Aramaic Greek milieu that he lives in, right? And the word for power in Aramaic can be a synonym for the word for avail, right? And that's where the standard reading of that passage comes from, that he's talking about a woman should have a veil on her head. It does make the most sense, right? There are people who try to say he's saying a woman should have power over her head. But no, the whole passage is saying that, a woman should keep her head veiled when she is prophesying and praying in the church. And why? Because of the angels, he says. Because of the angels. So that actually, when you really get down to it, that shows an idea that there are still angels. It isn't as if, even for Paul, there are, first of all, good angels in the assembly when you're praying all the time who are taking your prayers up to God. They're bringing the blessings of God down to you. They are intermediaries all the time. This is a very, very common Second Temple belief, right? And Stuckenbrock is the best person to bring that context to Paul and really show you that worldview that Paul is inhabiting there. And one thing that is kind of shocking, I think maybe Stuckenbrock doesn't go quite this far, but to me, it seems like Paul also doesn't believe that there was one time when the angels fell in the past and there's no danger. No, if a woman in the church has her head uncovered, she could tempt the angels to like fall again and like get in her head or something, right? Somehow infect, cause contagion, and this would be a common attitude toward femininity and the need for veils in general in the Mediterranean world, whether you're talking about Jews or Romans or whoever. This would be a very common patriarchal attitude there. To Paul's credit, he does sort of add a qualifier like, this is how we do things, and maybe you do things differently, but I can't imagine any different way to do it. So he doesn't present that as quite the highest level of truth. But at any rate, what he says is deeply based in this angel-steeped worldview. The world is full of angels. And, it reminds me of the Arabian Nights. When you read the original Arabian Nights, the jinn in that are, there's believing jinn, there's disbelieving jinn, and you could talk to the believing jinn and do something. Maybe most people would say you shouldn't, but the heroes of some interesting story that, leads to an interesting adventure certainly do things like this, and they get themselves into trouble and so on. So back in 1 Enoch, chapter 7, verse 2, And they conceived from them and bore to them great giants. And the giants begot Nephilim. And to the Nephilim were born Eliud. That's in crosses. We don't know what that is, I don't think. And they were growing in accordance with their greatness. They were devouring the labor of all the sons of men, and men were not able to supply them. And the giants began to kill men and to devour them. And they began to sin against the birds and beasts and creeping things and the fish and to devour one another's flesh. And they drank the blood. Then the earth brought accusation against the lawless ones. So this right here, I can give you a big payoff of this episode, which is the kingless generation reading of this. You can see they were devouring the labor of all the sons of men. This is what ruling classes do. If you have a materialist view of history and of class struggle, then you know that the ruling classes of any mode of production, they accumulate capital by devouring the labor of the sons of men. And the men were not able to supply them. This class struggle increases. It grows out of hand. It tends to, you know, this tendency toward accumulation is a tendency toward collapse as well. The giants began to kill men and to devour them. We know that ritual cannibalism is part of the archaeological remains of secret society ritual across the world. And so here we can go back to our Brian Hayden. We can go back to our Ian Hodder, and we can look at remains from Çatalhöyük and Ayın Hazel, and we can see that indeed the ruling classes, if that's who the giants are, they are in communication with some dubious entities, some supernatural entities of dubious qualities, and at least that's what they say. And at least they claim that these entities inspire them to devour the sons of men and to enslave others. In cases where those ruling classes do that, of course, there are trans-egalitarian communities, and the ones that were extant in modernity and recorded by ethnographers tended to be indigenous groups that had existed for tens of thousands of years in a very stable form, in a very stable way, where they did not have spiraling accumulation in this way. But Eurasia is another case. And so what I would like to plug in here is really the analysis of Near Eastern secret society remains, which, remember, Brian Hayden wants to challenge people to read those as secret society rituals and read those together with the ethnographic record. But I think there's every reason, even though I think most of these indigenous groups found much more, they were using the secret society ritual much more as a bulwark against spiraling class struggle. There's every reason to believe that what we see in the Near East is already moving in a much more extreme direction when you first see it in the layer known as pre-pottery Neolithic B, or PPNB. So in that sense, I think we can read First Enoch here as showing us a bit of dialectical materialist truth of the actual history of Eurasia. How about that? We get more details in chapter 8. Asa-El taught men to make swords of iron, and weapons and shields and breastplates, and every instrument of war. He showed them metals of the earth, and how they should work gold to fashion it suitably, and concerning silver to fashion it for bracelets and ornaments for women. And he showed them concerning antimony and eye paint and all matter of precious stones and dyes. And the sons of men made them for themselves and for their daughters, and they transgressed and led the holy ones astray. And there was much godlessness on the earth, and they made their ways desolate. Shemihaza taught spells and the cutting of roots. Hermani taught sorcery for the loosing of spells and magic and skill. Barakel taught the signs of the lightning flashes. Kokab-el taught the signs of the stars. Zik-el taught the signs of the shooting stars. Artikof taught the signs of the earth. Shamisiel taught the signs of the sun. Sahriel taught the signs of the moon. And they all began to reveal mysteries to their wives and to their children. And as men were perishing, the cry went up to heaven. So here, too, you see all kinds of technology that ethnographically and archaeologically we see that secret societies tend to monopolize for themselves. Of course, in reality, I think these technologies are created by the people. The wisdom of all these things are created by ordinary people who need to access them and use them. But ruling classes, to the extent that they arise, come along and they begin to, they would attribute these things to supernatural entities that only they can access, and only they, the incipient ruling class, or the members of the secret society, right? This would be a ritual society. I think many listeners will already know, but just in case this is your first episode ever, I will say these ritual societies arise in particularly rich hunter-gatherer environments where people have access to a lot of resources. There is a lot of surplus. And if you're a hunter, even if you don't have a lot of surplus, the desert foragers that survived in the south of Africa in the 20th century only had to do about 13 to 16 hours of what we would call work per week to meet their basic nutritional needs. And especially if you live in an area that provides a lot of nutrition, well, then you can use all the remaining time and energy that you have to create art. You can ponder the mysteries of the universe. You can create dances and dramas. You can make music. You can make sculptures. This is the kind of thing, Ainu epic, for example, whenever there's a kind of happy ending or at the beginning of a story, before something in particular happens, it's always, I was living along with my eyes fixed on a single spot, carving on treasures. I was weaving on my loom. As it's just a peaceful creation, peaceful life of creation and exploration of the world. Well, when you have that, though, there are certain times and certain places where the people who organize the rituals and those things, right, they begin to accumulate not surplus, material surplus at first, but accumulate honor, accumulate the regard of the community to themselves in the form of a claim on spiritual knowledge and a claim on access to spiritual entities. Sometimes we know the rituals, those who have been initiated into the higher levels of these ritual societies. Now they have the right to perform certain rituals and they have the right to invoke certain spiritual beings and so on. And they would then privatize all kinds of technology that actually the ordinary people would have just invented as part of their human life. But they could prioritize, they could privatize that and appropriate that and say that only we can do this because we have the permission of some god or other to do it, right? And so this story could be the result of a situation like that. I have said previously, one place I've said it is my conversation with Jimmy Fallon Gong on his show, Programmed to Chill. Many thanks to him, by the way, for helping with a lot of the research of this. You know, like I was in dialogue with him as I was producing this episode as well. So many thanks to Jimmy. I've said there that one way you could look at this is that maybe originally you have these incipient ruling classes claiming to protect the community from evil entities that are out there. And maybe those are the first gods. I don't know. This is just one theory. And then you could explain the archaeological finds, like on Crete, for example, And there are other places as well where you see a coexistence of kind of dark secret society ritual, very domineering sort of thing, like you'd see at Çatalhöyük, human sacrifice, human ritual cannibalism, this kind of thing, to appease the dark entities from which the secret society is alone able to protect the community, all of that. At some point, that gets hidden away inside the temple complex, inside the palace complex, rather, right? And then you get a forward-facing cult of a more good entities, right? A kind of universal god who wants you to do good, wants you to be a good citizen, and so on. This is one interpretation. This would fit some of the things like in Crete. You can see inside the palace, they're doing these kind of dark rituals in a very small space that's clearly only for a very elite group to participate in it. And then you also have a priesthood and you have forward-facing temples and so on, right? So this would be different, though. Obviously, in the world of the Hebrew Bible and of First Enoch, the ultimate reality is the good God who created the world. And then it's only after that that we have some kind of perversion of a good creation that, right, we get this intervention of the disobedient watchers. Even there, there's not, you know, this story goes on to sort of tell you how they are condemned. And it's not taken for granted that they will be condemned. There isn't the metaphysical distinction between like a demon and an angel. They're just all angels. The idea of the demonic is at least medieval creation, if not early modern. I wonder how much of it is actually even early modern. You could maybe even go there. I don't know. But there's no... Because daimon, you know, go back to the articulation, Hebrew to Greek to Latin and then to English. It changes with each thing. Daimon, a daimon is just a supernatural entity greater than a human of some kind, right? And not as big as maybe a theos, right? So, theos, again, cognate with deva or deus in Latin, Sanskrit, deva, Iranian, da'ewa, again, yeah. And as you do that, we've already discussed in the episode on Cain and Abel and Umisachibiko and Yamasachibiko from the Kojiki, we've seen that the word diabolos is actually just a very literal translation of ha-satan, right? A satan, a satan, is a accuser. So like a prosecutor, a prosecuting attorney, a district attorney in the American legal system would be the equivalent. And God has these guys and they go after people who do wrong. That's originally what a satan means. And, you know, whether you connect that, the whole framework of connecting that with the snake that was in the Garden of Eden, too, we'll get to that. That's in here, too. That's in here. That's in First Enoch and Jubilees. And that would be a main source for that whole kind of worldview, right? But that's only one very late development in the Hebrew worldview and very much originally, you know, the idea of a satan, that's just one of the watchers, right? The watchers are the guards. They guard over the universe and make sure that it goes the way that God wants it to go. And they're the overseers, kind of, right? But you can see how this parallels human society as well in that what do cops do? Cops are the original criminals. Cops are actually the most successful gangsters, right? Just like James C. Scott says in that note that I read from at the beginning of this episode. The founders of the state are the most successful gangsters, actually. And the Hebrew mythology and its flip, the way that it flips, you know, it flips and turns itself inside out. But with this move from the Satan being God's cop to Satan being an enemy who's opposed to God and represents some kind of totally different energy that is this demonic energy somehow. you know, the whole idea of that is a very historically conditioned one. It, not every human being that ever lived had that in their mind, that there is cosmic good and cosmic evil. That can be wild to think about, right? That doesn't mean you should go do cosmic evil. I'm not a Satanist in any kind of way. I don't think that's skillful, you know? In the Grotto of Truth, the Subliminal Jihad Discord server, I was asked a question recently, and it led right into some of my outlining for this episode. And so I must thank everyone there for helping me to kind of outline this, right? You helped me to outline this episode too. But we were talking about that there, you know, and I think that a lot of, I mean, it's part of, on the one hand, it's part of Platonic Orientalism, actually, the old-timey, and how old-timey do I mean? I mean early modern, maybe. I think I mean the proto-bourgeoisie was into saying, so Plato had some ancient mystical wisdom that he was getting from the East. What that actually was that in the East, they worship something other than the gods. The devas are evil, they think, and so that something else is good. Therefore, actually, maybe the Titans are good. Therefore, actually, Saturn is good, maybe. And they would connect that as well to what they saw of Punic ritual. That is the Phoenician civilization. Phoenicians are Semitic people that the Phoenician alphabet is the original parent of the Hebrew alphabet, isn't it? And the Phoenicians got all around the Mediterranean, maybe earlier than anybody else that we know of, anyway, that we have a name for. And they got all around to Portugal as well. Portugal sort of boasts the Phoenicians as being the earliest level of their civilization. But the Phoenician secret societies did, we now know from archaeological reality, have a child sacrifice element to their secret society ritual. And they would burn maybe the firstborn child of elite families. This concludes a free preview of a premium episode of the Kingless Generation podcast. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to continue, please head on down to patreon.com. Look for us on there. And for the low proletarian price of $3.33 a month, you get access to the Discord server, which has all kinds of great resources on it and great discussions about history, current events, you name it. And I hope to see you there. And you also get, of course, the back catalog of premium episodes, not just this one. Thank you for listening. Take care.